Wow, that was really great. Thank you, band, for leading us so well. Just really felt the presence of God, and it was a joy to worship Him with you guys. So this week is going to be the last of our DNA series. And, you know, the reason why One Light Church is named One Light Church, you know, obviously is in reference to what Christ calls Himself. In John, He talks about being the light of the world. Jesus says, I am the light of the world. And obviously, when we put the word light into our name, we're hoping that there's some aspect of Jesus being the light of the world that we want to be able to demonstrate as a community. So we're on the last of the four distinctives, gospel-centered, spirit-empowered, family on mission. And today we're going to be talking about what it means that we are a family that's on mission. That we're not just a community that gathers together and spends time together, but there is a task that God has given us as a community that we feel like we're supposed to engage in together. And, you know, I think that this message comes at a good time in this world. I think maybe some of all of the just irrational fear around COVID-19 has dissipated, at least in places like Thailand. I'm seeing now when I drive around town, not as many people are wearing masks, and some of the restaurants, they kind of semi-opened up, and they're like, ah, forget it. We don't really know what the rules are, so we'll just open up completely. But the reality is that it's doing it again. But the reality is that actually we got a little taste of what it means that the world is in darkness. And, you know, in Matthew 4:16, we're going to be looking at Matthew 5 today. But in Matthew 4:16, there is a reference to something that is from the prophet Isaiah, Matthew 4:16. It says, the people dwelling in darkness have seen a great light, and for those dwelling in the region and shadow of death, on them a light has dawned. And, you know, we've talked about this a number of times, but it's this idea that whereas we understand that the world is living in darkness, that the world is living in what this passage says is the shadow of death, or even in terms of being under the power of death that Satan wants to control us with, and just a lot of fear around safety and our health and death itself, that the coming of Jesus Christ, the coming of the Messiah, represented a great light being shown into this darkness, that a light had dawned. And it's a little bit of the messianic promises and the fulfillment that Jesus is talking about when he says that I am the light of the world. But you know, the thing is, Jesus, if you really think about it, yes, he was here on earth, people estimate around 33 years. But really, the first 30 years, there wasn't a lot of active ministry that he was engaging in. And if you look at the lifespan of Christ in terms of his ministry here on earth, it was only around three years or so. And just think about that. In the context of eternity, in the context of the history of the universe, whether you believe it's, you know, around 6,000 years old or billions of years old, the idea is that 3 years is really a very small amount of time, only just a drop in the bucket. So how could it be that Jesus was the light of the world and he's this fulfillment of this great promise if he was here for just a short time? And we see the brilliance of God and in his ultimate will and design that he had a plan that maybe didn't make sense to a lot of people, but makes sense even today for us. And just a little bit later in chapter 4, Matthew 4:19 to 20, Jesus, being this great light of the world, starts his plan to be able to shine his light. And it says, and he said to them, follow me, and I will make you fishers of men, referring to his first disciples, Peter and Andrew and James and John. Immediately, they left their nets and followed him. And for James and John, it says that they left their boat and their father as they followed him. So what does that mean? There seems to be a connection between Jesus calling his disciples, including us, calling his disciples, and them following Christ and salvation coming to this world. And so what we're going to look at today is that saving the world out of darkness is what it means to be a follower of Jesus Christ. So if you can open up your Bibles to Matthew 5, we're going to look at verses 13 to 16. And for those of you guys who've been Christians since Joseph and Micah's age, and you've heard a lot of Bible stories, this is something that you probably heard a lot about how Christians are supposed to be salt and light. But, you know, it's an oldie, but it's a goodie, so we'll take a look at it again. You are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. Lord Jesus, we just ask that this thing that you're declaring to us about ourselves, that we are salt, that we are light, that you would accomplish that, Lord. It's not something that we can muster up in our own strength, but rather we bow our knees before the Father, asking that all of the fullness of God, all of the fullness of Christ might be realized in us, that you might use us as agents of salvation on this earth. And we pray in Jesus' name, amen. So what does it mean that we are salt and light? And I'm just going to do a recap in case maybe some of you guys are newer Christians, you never really heard what the implications of being salt and light are. And so what does it mean to be salt? And I think we have to realize that back in those days, people went through tremendous measures in order to be able to make food taste a little bit better. They weren't Michelin star restaurants. You know, we didn't have probably a lot of the Thai food that exists today. And if you have ever had Jewish food, like if you have Jewish friends like I have in the United States and have had opportunities to taste Jewish food, it's actually quite bland. You know, if I were to rank the top cuisines of the world, I think maybe like Chinese food and unbiased Korean food, you know, but like flavorful foods like Thai food and Italian food would be at the top. Very few people would put Jewish food at the top. And if you, the first time I had matzo ball soup, it's this traditional kind of Jewish dish. You're just like, what is this? It's like a wet piece of dough that doesn't really have a lot of flavor. It's pretty bland. And so actually people in those days put a high value on things that could make food taste a little bit better. And there is an aspect of that, that there is this enlightenment or this brightening and this kind of bringing something that is of quality that Christians bring into this world. And I have to say that I quite enjoy the company of Christians. And I enjoy having conversations, and the hope and joy and the light that Christians can bring can be very buoying. It can be something that is very helpful for us. Salt is also an essential. Our bodies need it. 0.4% of our bodies are actually made up of sodium, and if we didn't have any salt in our bodies, we would die. Which is why, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I went up to Yafu, and I was just out there in the hot sun trying to lay some cement down on the road. Mitch was there with me, Joe was there, and my boys. And one of the things that they brought, in addition to just water, was this thing called Super Sport, which is this drink that comes in the little bottle. It's yellow, it's like Gatorade, and it's salty when you drink it. Because the thing is, when you're especially in a hot environment like this and you're sweating, if you've ever on a hot day just licked your arm, right? It's salty, you know? And actually that day when I came home, I noticed that I had sweat so much that there were these white lines all around my body. It was the salt that was coming out. And if I don't have those things, then, you know, you can become confused and lightheaded and weak. And even if people have a severely low quality level of salt in their bodies, it could even lead to coma and death. It's something that was absolutely essential, especially for people in hotter climates who did a lot of walking and doing things outside. It's also a cleansing agent. There was an antiseptic quality to salt. And so what you would do is you would take dirty food, or you would take meats that had just been killed, and you would throw salt on there just to be able to kill the bacteria and prevent certain diseases from happening. It was also a preserving agent. They didn't have refrigerators back in the day. They didn't have air conditioners. And so when you were to kill some food to be, an animal to be able to eat, you would have to preserve them in some way by putting salt, which is why, you know, in our day today, we still salt foods in order to be able to keep them. And if you've ever been to our house and had kimchi or ever made kimchi, you know that the first thing that you do is you take a bunch of cabbage and you throw salt on it. And that's one of the processes that you do. And because of these reasons, salt was really valuable back in those days. And how many of you guys know the English word salary and how where it originates from? And there was a Roman historian, Pliny the Elder, who said that actually there used to be a time when Roman soldiers, instead of being paid in money, would be paid in salt. And so the word salary comes from the Latin word salarius. And there was just this idea that salt was an absolute essential, and it was so valuable that people even used it as currency. Even in scripture, there's an idea that when you're sacrificing meat, you add salt. Or that there are certain covenants that are made with salt because of the preserving qualities, and that a covenant made in salt is a covenant that tends to last forever. And so that's something of what it means that we are salt in this world. We bring flavor, and we bring life, and we bring cleansing, and we bring preserving and value into this world. We are supposed to be life-saving, preserving agents to the people of this earth, and that's what it means to be salt. What does it mean that we are light? We are the light of the world. And, you know, in one of the Psalms, Psalm 30, it talks about how my soul waits for the Lord more than watchmen for the morning. And there is this idea in the ancient world, and nowadays we can have a lot of kind of comfort and safety and security. We can have electricity so that we can have lights even when we go outside in some of the streets. But back in the day, in the ancient world, it was dark at night. And it was a dangerous time to be outside. And you never knew. Even if you were in a fortified city, you always had to worry that the enemies would try to advance. Or if you were outside the gates and it was in a dark place, that there might be some bandits or criminals that might come and hurt you. And light represented this hope and this life and protection and safety. And it talks about light, that we are like a city that's on a hill. And I can just tell you, that recently I experienced this. Last year, a couple of months ago, we had an opportunity to go visit Mussoorie, India, and it's in this remote part of northeastern India, and you have to fly on a propeller plane into a city called Dehradun, and then you have to drive about 2 hours to get up into this mountain town. And, you know, this is the first time I had been there, and I know that India could potentially be more dangerous, and we had somebody that we didn't really know come and pick us up from the airport, and we're driving away from the city, and as we're driving away from the city, it gets darker and darker and darker. And then as you get it up into the mountains and you're climbing the hills, you're just like, oh my gosh, where is this guy taking us? Where are we going to end up? But then it was just the most amazing picture that I had ever seen. And it's a small city that's up on the hill in Mussoorie. It's a town of only about 60,000 people. But as you get near, you could just see it was almost like a very strong cluster of stars just dotting the mountaintop. And you realize, okay, there are people there. There's a civilization there. And when we go there, our friends are going to be there. There's going to be a nice hotel where we're going to be able to shower and we're going to be able to sleep and get some food. And it just fills you with hope when you just see that picture of light on top of a hill. And in the passage of Matthew that we read earlier, imagine what it's like to be living in the shadow of death, just living in darkness when you don't know what's going to happen. You have to live in fear. But then thinking about this city that you can go to that's bright and it's light and there are going to be resources and there are going to be protection. Jesus says, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. And through the way that we shine, the way that we shine before others, there's an opportunity for us to bring life to a world that is living in the shadow of darkness. So how do we do it? Now that we understand what it means to be salt, what it means to be light, there are a couple of insights from this passage that goes to show some important ways in which that we can be salt and life. And I think the first thing that is important for us to recognize from verse 13 is the idea that Jesus says that we are salt and light. It's not that we can be salt and light. It's not that some special people, like the professional missionaries or pastors, are salt and light. And then there are laymen or rank-and-file Christians who get to not be salt and light. No, every single Christian is salt and light. And it's something that you don't work to do. It's not something that you try to do. Jesus is declaring that you are salt and light. It's not optional. He says, if you follow me, I will make you fishers of men. He doesn't say, if you follow me, you will have an opportunity to be fishers of men. He doesn't say, if you follow me, some of you guys can choose to be career fishermen, fishers of men. He doesn't say that. If you follow me, I will make you fishers of men. You are salt. You are light. Mitch, you are salt. Joe, you are light. And it was just wonderful to hear A share. I didn't know. We had prayed in Life Group for a couple of weeks now that the people of her restaurant, that there would be opportunities to share the gospel with them. I didn't realize that last week that she had an opportunity to do that. What an amazing thing. That A says, hey, you know what? I am salt. I am light. I'm going to use this opportunity to interact with this person who's suffering from depression. The other thing that is important for us to remember is that we are the salt and light of the earth, of the world. It is a remarkable thing. And I think a lot of times we think about Jesus and the benefits of Jesus and what it means to us. And we're very happy that Jesus died and rose again and saved us and that we get to have a relationship with him and that we get to experience love and joy and peace. And maybe for some of us, we say, hey, you know what? It's not just me, but my family. I get to be a saving agent for my wife and for my children, bring them to church. I can read the Bible to them. I can teach them about the Bible. I can talk to them. And I'm going to be an agent for preserving, and I'm going to be an agent for life and salvation to my family. But even that is too small. We are salt and light for the entire world. We are salt and light for the entire earth. And not even Chiang Rai. Even Chiang Rai is too small. Even if you broaden it to Thailand, it's too small. Because we are a church and we represent an expression of the body of Christ, we have to be people who are for the whole earth. And actually, we wouldn't be here today, and we wouldn't be worshiping Jesus here, if not for the fact that there were many, many churches all around the world who didn't just say, hey, we're in Brea, California, we only care about Brea, California. Or a church in Cape Town saying, we're only caring about the people that are in Cape Town. But they said, no, we are supposed to be salt and light for the whole earth. Our mission is the entire earth. Now, of course, because we're here, we have an opportunity to be able to relate to the people that God brings into our lives that we see on a day-to-day basis. But when we have opportunities to go and encourage brothers and sisters in Africa, when we have opportunities to go and encourage and support the work that God is doing in places like India and Nepal, we take that. And we don't say, no, I'm kind of more about my family. I'm just kind of more about only the people in Thailand, only the people here in northern Thailand and Chiang Rai. Of course that's important. But we are for the whole earth. We are on a mission together with all of our brothers and sisters all across the world to evangelize the whole earth and see Christ formed in people all around the world. And it's an amazing privilege that we get to do it in partnership with a movement like Advance. The next point is that if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? And it's this imperative that we have to be distinct from the world. There's a difference. I don't know if you've ever tried it, but if you were to take a clump of concrete and you were to put it into your mouth. Josh says, don't do that. Is that not good for you? Okay. Or if you were to take baby powder and put it into your mouth. Or if you were to take flour and just put it into your mouth. It's going to taste different from salt, right? And I don't know if you guys know, but salt is not 100% salt. What I mean by that is the thing that makes salt salty is this thing called sodium. or sodium chloride to be more exact. And actually salt, your typical table salt, only has about 40% sodium chloride. And what would sometimes happen if salt was left outside was that in the way that it exchanged or interacted with the air, the sodium chloride would dissipate. It would be removed from the salt. And so you would have this white powdery substance that was mostly things like calcium and potassium and other things. And so it would look like salt, and you would put it in your mouth, and it wouldn't be salty at all. And it wouldn't have all of the same benefits. It wouldn't be able to cleanse. It wouldn't be able to preserve. It wouldn't be able to make your food any more flavorful. And you know, the reality is that there are Christians, and even ourselves, there are times in our lives when we're not that salty. And we have the appearance, and we might indicate on our national ID registrations or when we apply for visas and we say, yeah, we believe in Jesus, we are Christians. But what happens when human beings interact with us, when people observe us and have relationships with us and observe the way that we go about living their lives? Are they going to be able to say, wow, there's something different? Have you ever put like a spoonful of salt in your mouth? You put some salt in your mouth, you're like, oh, your face just makes this expression because it's so distinct. Very different than you put a spoonful of baby powder in your mouth, right? I used to do it for fun when we had babies. No, but there is something different about a bland, tasteless white powder and salt. And we need to be able to live our lives in a way where we're okay with being distinct, and that even in us wanting to be gospel-centered, even in us wanting to be filled with grace and being able to communicate grace with our words and with our lives, in us wanting to be spirit-filled, even in the way that we relate to each other and how we demonstrate godly relationships within the context of Christian community, there has to be something where they're like, you are very different than what the alternative is. You are very different than the darkness that I see in the rest of the world. And it's something that is flavorful. It's something that is wonderful. It's life-giving. And I want to be a part of it. Otherwise, what Jesus is saying here is that it has the power for nothing. That's the exact translation. So if you're not salty, if you're not distinct and countercultural, it's as if you're a Christian in name only, but you have the power to do nothing, and that we will need to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet, utterly useless. You know what? If salt isn't going to be salty at all, just dump it on the ground. It serves no purpose. There's no purpose having it in your kitchen in order to be able to flavor your food. The next thing, and it's related to this last point, is that a city set on a hill cannot be hidden. That a lamp has to be placed on a stand, and that this light has to be given in a way that it's able to be seen by all. It's given to all, okay? Sometimes I cook in the kitchen, not very often, and my food is not as good as Marcia's, but I will try. And so I'm not an expert in cooking. I'm not all that great at it, like someone like Christine as well. Thank you so much today for that wonderful brunch. But I am a good enough cook to know that if I want to flavor my food and I want to make something a little bit saltier because it's bland, I have to take the salt out of the salt shaker and put it into the food, right? I'm not going to be able to put a bunch of stuff. I'm making fried rice in the wok, put some rice in, put all the veggies and the meat in. Oh, man, it's bland. I need to add some salt. So I just take the salt and put it next to the frying pan and see if I can flavor the food that way. You know, if I want to preserve some meat, go to Macro and buy up some beef. I want to try to make some beef jerky. And then rather than pouring the soy sauce onto the meat, I just throw the bottle on top of the meat. That's not going to get anything accomplished. And we laugh about that. It would be a ridiculous thing for us to go about living our lives in this kind of a way. But actually, there are a lot of Christians who live in Christian ghettos. And it's not a literal ghetto. You don't move into a muban that's just Christians only and everybody's a Christian and we never leave, we don't let anybody in. But we live our lives in a way where, you know what, everybody that we see all the time are only Christians. We only work for Christian companies. We only send our kids to Christian schools. And even then, there might be some non-Christians there. So you know what? Let's pull them out and we'll just teach them at home because we can't have them interacting with people that aren't Christian. And we live lives in a way where we're not fully engaged in the world. When Jesus is talking about lighting a lamp and not putting under a basket, you know, sometimes Marcia will look at baskets and say, hey, it'd be a great place to put a light inside of it and hang it in our house. But the basket was actually a measuring bowl and not like the kind of basket where light would seep out. And so it'd be like lighting a lamp and then making it completely dark. It wouldn't make any sense to do that. You love baskets. We need to understand that we are called to be distinct. We're supposed to be salty. We're supposed to be bright. And then we're supposed to go out into the world and engage in a way where the light and the salt can interact in a way where it's going to have an impact. And the last point, so that you may see your good works, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father. And I think this is an important one. It's not really talked about often. But do you understand that we are on mission, not for our glory, but for God's glory? And I think it's a very important thing to remember. We are on mission, not for our glory, but for God's glory. And so the phrase is, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father. But sometimes we actually go about evangelizing and disciple making and even engaging in good deeds, like being generous and giving money to the poor and these types of things, not for God's glory, but so that they may see God's works and give glory to you, rather than seeing your works to give glory to God. And you know what happens when we engage in works because we want to glorify ourselves rather than glorify God? We take a lot of pride in it. We can become insecure when things don't go our way and get overly discouraged if people don't respond to our good deeds and our evangelism efforts. We disciple someone, we pour into them for a long period of time, and then they still continue to reject Jesus. Now, if we're for our own glory, then we can get very discouraged and say, I need to see results, because seeing results and seeing people converted are going to make me feel good about myself. And then I'm going to be able to post this great Instagram picture of baptizing these people that I've been on mission for. But it's actually for the glory of God that we do these things. And it means that because it's for God's glory that we're doing these things, because he's the Lord of the harvest, and ultimately these are his children and his sheep, we can say no when it's something that God is not calling us to. And I know that there are people, in the way that they evangelize, they just need to prove themselves. That there's some aspect of validation or approval that they need to gain from man or from God. And so they will burn themselves out and do too much, more than what God is asking them to do, rather than just simply walking in step as the Spirit leads in the ways that we're supposed to invest. And what's amazing about this thing is that this is the first time in the Gospel of Matthew that the word Father is used to describe God. Give glory to your Father. Ultimately, what causes us to want to be on mission, what causes us to want to be engaged in a way where we can be a life-saving, a life-preserving agent for the people that are stuck in the darkness of this world is from being sons and daughters of God. We are his children. And we love God, and we know that his heart breaks and yearns, and he has compassion and mercy to see many, many sons adopted back into his family. And that's the simple motivation that we have, is that those people out there are my Father's children. They're not my way of being able to feel better about myself. They're his children. And what motivates us and what drives us to seeing these people come to a relationship with Jesus Christ is to please our Father and to see him glorify. So why don't we do it? How many of you guys can put up your hands and say, hey, I'm really good at being salt and light. Now I'm really good at being on mission. Why don't we do it? Why is it hard? What's hard about being salt and light in this world? And I think one of the reasons is this thing that comes right before the passage that we read. We started from verse 13. And if you go back to verses 11 and 12, Jesus talks about this reality. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of fear against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. You know, Marcia had a conversation with one of her friends who's a counselor in education in California. And she's saying that a lot of Christian schools in the U.S. are having a hard time. Now, if you ask people in Thailand, they'll say, oh, people in America, people in Europe, they're all Christian. They all believe in Christianity. But I think we understand that the world is becoming rapidly postmodern and becoming post-Christian. It's not cool to be Christian anymore. And in fact, in many places in the United States, if you're a Christian and you hold on to the values that Christians have traditionally held on to, you are viewed as a bigot, somebody who's closed-minded and old-fashioned and too conservative and not in line with the enlightened progressive thoughts of today. And, you know, I see it all the time. Even people that I used to know who were formerly Christian, when it comes to politics or seeing just the stuff that's in the news, very quick to insult Christianity and Christians and the things that we believe. And it used to be that you'd have to go to a place like the Middle East or you'd have to go to a place like India in order to be reviled and persecuted for being Christian. But it seems like nowadays, anywhere you go in the world, there are opportunities when you claim to be a follower of Jesus and you try to preach the gospel message to be reviled and hated, be falsely accused, and be persecuted. And that's hard because we are communal creatures and we like to be well thought of by people. We like to be respected by people. We like to be liked and loved by people and feel like we are accepted and we are on the inside. And people actually hate rejection. We hate being hated. And some of us hate being thought of as stupid. And it just is a reality that there are many people in this world, they only believe in science. Not a lot of Nacho Libre friends. They only believe in science. It's called scientism and rationalism. How can you believe in a virgin birth? How can you believe that somebody died and rose again? But we lead with those things. Now, I believe that the Son of Man came down, that he lived a perfect life. He died and his heart stopped beating for 3 days, and then it started beating again. That just through speaking his word, God put everything into motion and into place. But if we speak in those types of ways, there's a good chance nowadays that we're going to be hated, we're going to be looked at as stupid. And it's the thing that causes us to hesitate to interact with the world. You know, we think that, hey, you know what? If I start hanging out with these group of people over there on Jet Yod, and maybe we'll sit down and we'll want to share a meal with them. But then if I start talking about Christianity and how I live by a different set of morals and a different set of rules, then they're going to automatically think that I'm going to be judging them and that I'm probably a hypocrite. I'm going to think I'm more righteous than them and they're going to reject me. And if I even open my mouth, then I'm going to share about Jesus and they're not going to want to hear. And in fact, they'll insult me and say, why don't you take Jesus and just get out of here? I don't want to hear that. Like, I already heard about that. There's nothing there. It's not true. And you're an idiot for believing that stuff. It just is a reality that we need boldness because persecution and rejection and hatred is a part of being salt and light in this world. So how do we do it? How do we do it? And, you know, I think what's amazing about Christ is that before he talks about us being salt and light, and giving us this encouragement and this imperative to be salt and light in this world, that he preaches the Beatitudes to us before telling us this reality that we are salt and light, and we are to be salt and light on this earth. He talks about our blessedness. in Matthew 5, 3 to 12, with Beatitudes referring to blessing or blessedness. Jesus says, you are blessed, and kind of a more accurate translation. And, you know, I think in Thailand, you know, you have the phrase that Thais will say to each other often, chok di, but like Thai Christians will say prachao oipon instead. But actually, in the Greek, a more accurate translation is good fortune. Jesus is saying good fortune is yours because of this and because of this and because of this. And what's funny is that the things that are good for us, the blessedness that we have, is very different than what the world would say is blessedness. And it actually feels like a curse. It talks about being humble and lowly. It talks about being meek. It talks about being poor in spirit. It talks about mourning and thirsting and hungering and being persecuted and being falsely accused. These types of things feel more like curses, or the way that the world looks at them, it looks more like curses. And yet, to the people that can be described in that way, Jesus says, you are blessed. You actually have good fortune. And the reason why is because for those who are poor in spirit, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Those who mourn will be comforted. Those who are meek will inherit the earth. Those who hunger and thirst for righteousness will be satisfied. Those who are merciful will receive mercy. The pure in heart shall see God. Peacemakers, they shall be called sons of God. And even the persecuted, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And so there are these things that are the unshakable aspects of our blessedness that have nothing to do with the blessedness that the earth really thinks of, that the world thinks of when they think about being blessed. And yet it's ours. And if you really think about it, the ways that the world views what good fortune is, how many people know people that are really fortunate when it comes to those types of things, and yet are miserable, and yet live these cursed existences with a lot of darkness? You know, I had a chance when I was working in America, I knew a lot of really, really rich people, millionaires. And, you know, you look at their lives and you're like, you have everything that you could possibly want, and yet you seem to be depressed, or you seem to be a really angry and bitter person. What is it that's going on? And the reality is that there are these invisible things that are the truths of what Jesus earned for us on the cross that mark true blessedness, that mark true good fortune, that are different than what the world is telling us that we need. You know, earlier this week I was watching a Thai movie, and there was a monk in this Thai movie, and the people that were the main stars of the movie, they went to these monks, or they went to this monk, and they make an offering. You know, maybe it was food that they provided, and the monk was telling them, hey, he was blessing them. He was saying, I hope that you are going to be beautiful. You're going to be wealthy, and you're going to be healthy. And it just kind of made me realize, oh, that's very common in this world to think that if you're beautiful, if you have health, if you have wealth, that those are the things that are marked by blessedness. And it's interesting that it's human tendency to want to pay a price in order to be able to receive that type of good fortune or that type of blessing. And it's so much of the world's religions are similar to that. And it just made me realize that at the cross, what we have an opportunity to do is go before the one who is actually capable of blessing us in real, eternal, and significant ways. And there's this amazing exchange that takes place where we're not the ones that bring something of value to try to earn blessing for ourselves, but actually Jesus pays the price and takes all of the curses of sin upon himself and gives us the blessedness that is his. I'm going to show this picture. And I preached on this before. I used this illustration before. And so if you guys were here 2 years ago and I preached and you know the answer, don't answer. But does anybody know what this is? Who knows? Just raise of hands. Any idea what this is? Brent, you don't remember? Mitch, you surely remember. All right, Mitch was not paying attention. Marcia knows. All right, well, I'm glad that I brought this up. Okay, so I'm going to give you an opportunity to guess, okay? This is a spacecraft that allows people to be able to go into space and return safely. Or do you think that this might actually be a weapon of some sort, a rocket that can be used as a weapon of mass destruction? What do you think? Who thinks it's a spacecraft? Okay, who thinks it's a weapon? Who thinks it's a space weapon? Okay, I was tricking you guys. Actually, it's none of those things. It's neither a weapon nor a spacecraft. Okay. Yeah. Who said submersible? Oh, yes. Oh, did you? Okay. This is actually called a McCann rescue bell, and it was developed around the 1930s, around the times between World War I and World War II, because what was becoming popular in those days among the people that were at war, and as people were spending a lot of money to develop their navies, was the submarine. It was around the time that the submarines were being developed. And, you know, we know that the Germans during World War II used the U-boats in a very powerful way to destroy the Allied naval forces. But sometimes what would happen with these submarines is that they would malfunction, and they would end up going all the way to the bottom of the ocean. And, you know, the thing is, at the bottom of the ocean, there's so much pressure that from the inside, you can't hope to be able to open the door. And in fact, if you were to open the door, the pressure would just kill everybody inside instantly. And even if you were to somehow be able to come out, during that process of coming up, you would get this, what scuba divers get, this sickness from the pressure changing too drastically. And so they had to figure out a way to rescue people that were stuck in submarines. And in May of 1939, actually, this nightmare of a submarine malfunctioning became a reality on the USS Squalus. It was a US submarine, and in the Atlantic Ocean, it ended up sinking. There was a malfunction in one of the valves, and they couldn't expel the water out, so it went all the way down to the bottom of the ocean, about 240 feet down, and there were 33 people that were stuck inside of the submarine. And can you imagine what it might be like to be stuck at the bottom of the ocean in a submarine, and you have some electricity, but that's going to go out. You have some food and water, but that's going to run out. And you know, the scary thing is actually there isn't enough oxygen for you to be able to be there with 33 people for very long. And when the USS Squalus went down, they thought, okay, well, this is great. This is a great time for us to use this brand new invention, the McCann rescue bell, and use it to be able to go down. And so what the rescue bell allows you to do is it goes down and it will suction on to an opening in the submarine, and it'll pressurize it in a way that you can open up the hatch and be able to rescue people, not more than four or five people at a time. And so imagine you're one of these people that are at the bottom of the ocean in a submarine, and you're just waiting in the silence of the deep of the ocean, and all of a sudden you hear a knock. And you're like, what could that be? I mean, it seems like there's somebody there and somebody's trying to communicate to us. What could that be? And so as soon as the McCann rescue bell went down and attached to the submarine, people started to realize there's somebody out here. But how can they possibly save us? The people that were down there had no idea that this invention existed. And they used Morse code, like beep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep-deep- people inside the submarine asked the people that had dove down to try to rescue them was, is there any hope? And can you imagine what it's like to sit, pitch darkness, knowing that you're just slowly waiting for your life to end, for your last breath. And then to hear this knock. And you don't want to dare to have hope. And you ask the question, is there any hope? And the response that you get is, yes, and we're going to save you. And so they took the first group of people and they gave the weakest people to be able to go first. And this McCann rescue bell went down time and time again. It made 5 separate dives. And they were able to save every last one of the 33 people. And you know what? That's what the church is. We are a family that's on mission. We're on a rescue mission. And that's what it means to be salt and light. There is an entire world that is stuck at the bottom of the ocean, utterly hopeless without Christ. And we go to them and we knock and we answer the question of hope. Yes, there is hope. It's what A did for her employee. She didn't know that there was a hope out of the depression that she was experiencing. And what's amazing is that for us, we are the rescued that become co-rescuers with Jesus Christ. And imagine if the McCann rescue bell goes down and saves people out of the submarine. And as soon as the people come out of the submarine, they say, hey, guess what? Actually, this ocean is littered with people. And in a place like Thailand, we're talking about 60 million plus people that are stuck down in submerged submarines. And the people that just rescued you say, hey, we need every last person to be engaged in this rescue mission. Why don't you come down with us on the next dive and help us to be able to rescue? And that's the reality, is that we ourselves were stuck in that submarine, utterly without hope. I know that I was there, pursued after the things of the world, thinking that there was hope there. It did not satisfy. It did not bring me comfort. Didn't love me the way that I needed to be loved. And the only reason why I have any hope now, both for this life and the next, is the fact that Jesus Christ dove down from heaven and came down to my darkest state and rescued me out. And he's inviting us and say, okay, now follow me and I will make you fishers of men. Who doesn't want to be a part of that rescue mission? Jesus, we thank you. And even this thing of mission is something that we can make so much about ourselves, that it's a job that we do. Whether it's to make ourselves feel better, whether it's to gain some sort of approval, whether it's to try to gain favor from you. Hey, if I am a good Christian, I just do these things. Won't you be pleased with me? Won't you be pleased with me? And we need to be reminded that we are blessed by you. We are loved by you. We are saved by you before we do even one good thing for your sake. And Lord, that there are other people in this room that me telling them that we are to be salt and light, it's like chalkboard, like scratches on a chalkboard. Because we know that's what we're supposed to do, and yet we feel powerless to do it. We're not qualified. I'm not going to know what to say. People have treated me poorly my whole life. They look down on me. I've been rejected. Not that well-educated. I'm not that articulate. I'm not going to know what to say. People are going to think I'm stupid. It's going to hurt when a door gets slammed in my face. Or worse, what if I have to suffer? What if I have to pay a price? What if I'm persecuted, thrown into jail? Even killed for sharing about Jesus. I don't know if I'm strong enough to be able to stand that. And what Jesus says to that is, I will not make you bear any more than you can handle. So come and follow me. My yoke is easy, my burden is light. Jesus, we ask that you would allow us to experience your love in such a way that no matter what cost we have to bear, no matter what price we have to pay, it will be out of the surplus, the abundance of the blessedness that we receive from you at the cross. And help us through the power of your Spirit, through our knowledge of your love, to be able to have our hearts broken for those who are around us, who are in utter hopeless darkness, living in the shadow of death. Increase in us today. Holy Spirit, come. Fill each and every one of us. Help us to be able to comprehend the height, the depth, the width of your love. Not just comprehended in our minds, but in the deepest parts of our hearts and souls, to be able to feel it and experience it and intimately know it. That through your Spirit, through your power being in us, we might be filled with all the fullness of Christ. We would be salty, that we would be brilliant, radiating the glory of God that is found in the face of Jesus. And help us to go low into the depths of people's lives, where they are, and be able to communicate the hope that can be found in Jesus. We earnestly pray this in Jesus' mighty name.